Okay. So this is Rebecca Holt with Dave Squire on the 29th of February, 2012, and we're doing this recording for the Washington County Museum. So let's start with your full name, your birth date, and your place of birth.
David Charles Squire, birthday July 5th, 1944, and place of birth was Fitzsimmons Army Hospital in Denver, Colorado.
Okay. And when did you move from Denver to Ashland?
I think when I was probably two.
Two?
My parents are from Eastern Oregon, so my dad was stationed at Fitzsimmons Army Hospital during the war, so that's why I was there. So I consider myself a native Oregonian. So I was in Ashland from the time I was two, probably.
And you were there until the time you went to college?
Yep.
What sort of things were you interested in as a child?
I call it pre-engineering studies. I made bombs. I caught things on fire. Caught the chicken house on fire. Experimented with gunpowder. Caught the local golf course on fire. Stuff like that.
Did you get into some pretty serious trouble?
I did, yeah.
Hopefully no major consequences.
No. I call it, pre-engineering studies. So mm-hmm. It was all scientific based.
Mm-hmm. And how did you do in school? Did you like science?
I was really good in math.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was a teacher and then a principal and then a professor, and he specialized in math. And so I was taught math from before I was in school, so I was really good at math.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the stuff in school I did okay. I didn't really have to work that hard, which was probably not good, but I didn't develop very good study habits.
And then did you go to college when you turned 18?
Yeah, went to Oregon State.
Mm-hmm.
Got an engineering. I went to my counselor at the high school, and he said, well, you get math when you go to Oregon State and be an engineer. And I said, okay. So I went there.
How was your time there?
It was good. Met my wife there. Didn't do that well in school. I think of my whole family that went to Oregon State, I probably got the lowest GPA. So my mom went there. My dad went there a little bit. My wife went there. My three kids went there. They all did better than I did. So, but I got out.
Did you meet your wife in the engineering program?
No, she was in medical technology. So I met her through a fraternity I was in for a very short time.
Were there many women in the engineering program at the time that you?
One.
And how many were there in your graduating class?
One. So that was in electrical engineering. I don't know what the other engineering disciplines were. But I think there were probably more in like industrial engineering and civil engineering, but mm-hmm. there's only one in electrical engineering.
Did OSU have connections to the high-tech industry, or did they help you once you graduated with a career?
No. They didn't have, most of the universities now have co-op programs. You go, your sophomore year, junior year, you go work in the summer, but they didn't have anything like that. I did get a summer job at Pacific Power and Light as a programmer, but I think that was just through the job placement office at the school. It wasn't really, there were connections, but not with the students so much.
Mm-hmm.
I think the professors probably were hooked into Tektronix. I'm sure they were in some way or another, but, and they had their little consulting gigs, but nothing I got involved in.
So what did you do once you graduated then?
I went to work for NASA, Ames Research Center down in the Bay Area. It was the backwaters of NASA. Aeronautics, not so much space. They had life sciences. I wanted to be a life sciences engineer, biomedical engineer. So I went there and discovered I didn't really want to be a biomedical engineer because we mostly killed animals in gruesome ways, and not on purpose, but through the research, and so that wasn't too pleasant. But I was there about 2.5 years, I think, and then to Tektronix.
And how did you end up working at Tektronix? Did you seek out a position there, or did they?
I had applied there when I was for a summer job when I was at school, and didn't get it. But I'd always heard about Tektronix. I remember when I was little, my dad talked about Tektronix, about how they used to bring in all these management gurus and all this training and stuff they did. He was very impressed by that. And then my mom had she was in a small investment club, and when Tech went public, they bought some of their stock and did okay on it. So, you know, and it was really about the only high-tech place in town, and it was Tektronix and Electroscientific Industries, and that was it. And I didn't like California. My wife and I and our kids did not like California, so almost from the time I got there, I started looking for a job back up here. And actually, a guy I worked with at NASA had a cousin that was there and said they were hiring, and he didn't want to leave, so he told me about it, and so I ended up getting a job at Tektronix.
And how long were you at NASA?
About 2.5 years.
Okay. So what position did you start in at Tektronix?
I started in a group, a test group that built test systems for the 7000 series scopes. It's called Electronic Industrial Engineering. We call it EIEIO.
So, can you maybe describe a little bit in detail what your work was like?
In that position, we were building test systems for the 7000 series was a brand new scope line that Tech had, and we were building test systems for manufacturing. So one of the projects I worked on was we used, back in those days, we were using PDP-8s, digital equipment, PDP-8 computers, 8-bit, very rudimentary computers, and they used paper tape for all the programming. And I was asked to put together a substitute for the paper tape using cassettes, and so I worked on that project for a while. And then I worked on an automated test system that you could put boards down and it would go test the boards. So it was mainly that kind of stuff in that particular job.
Mm-hmm. And then how long did you do that?
Oh, good question. How long did I do that? So I did that for probably 3 years. And then I went to... Then our group got acquired by another group. There was a lot of... At Tektronix, there was constant shuffling of organizations and moving around. It was one of the great things about the company is that, you know, if you were somewhere where you didn't like, you didn't have to worry about it because it would change shortly. And it was a really good thing because people got to move around and see how different things work. So our group got acquired by the systems group, which was building commercial automatic test systems. And so I did design on it was about as big as this room, the system, and it had, you'd put an integrated circuit, that's when integrated circuits are just starting to come out. You put an integrated circuit in there and it had all these boards that would, each board would attach to a pin in the integrated circuit, and you could run all these signals in there and get signals back and all that kind of stuff. So it was the S3260 system. So I worked on that. But it was a really weird job because our boss, he never came out of his office. You know, he'd come in your desk in the morning. We had these things called Z-grams. His name is Al Zimmerman, so he'd leave a little note on your desk, you know, do this and Z. And you'd never see him, you know. The only time I ever talked to him was when I told him I was leaving. So that was interesting. And so from there, I went to a group in, what was it called? It was Spectrum Analyzers. It was called RF Instruments. It worked on a all-digital test system. It was the first product that Tech was going to do that ever used a microprocessor. It was the first all-digital instrument. And I was a digital engineer. That's what I specialized in. And most engineers at Tech were analog, if you know what that means. But anyway, but I was the only digital guy. I think I might have been the only digital guy in the company. But so Intel had just come out with their 4-bit microprocessor, first microprocessor ever, and so we incorporated that into an instrument, built this all digital thing, and then I probably have to go into a bunch of technical babble to but it was a network analyzer used for measuring S parameters, which are microwave kind of things. So it was going to test this microwave device from like 100 megahertz up to 20 gigahertz, which at 20 gigahertz at that time was a really, really high frequency. It's not anymore, but it was then. But it had all kinds of amazing technology in it. We had, it was the first product that ever had an all digital front panel. It had a digital display. We could present data in polar coordinates or Cartesian coordinates, all this kind of stuff. And it was really, really pushing the state of the art. And we had a small team that it was, people, you know, have looked at that product. I should say it never got to market because we had some rules of physics we would have had to violate in order to get it to work when it finally came down to it. But the thing was around in tech labs for 20 years, and I remember people looking at it and not being able to believe we did something like that at that time. That was probably 74, 75 or something like that. But nobody was doing anything with microprocessors then.
When you say violate rules of physics, what do you mean?
We were trying to get a signal to noise ratio of about 40 dB, and when we did and there were actually three of us trying to do the mathematical analysis of this, and we all three came up with different answers. Finally, we hired this kid from MIT, who's like probably the smartest person I've ever met, and he did the analysis and showed that just based on the physics of these microwave devices, that there was enough noise in them that we could not get below that. So we ended up only being able to get about 20 dB signal to noise ratio, which was not enough to make it a viable product. So we were trying to, there was a Hewlett Packard at the time had a way of measuring these S parameters on these microwave devices that was basically a swept frequency. So you'd put a signal in and you just change the frequency and look at the transmission, for example. We were using a pulse approach where if you look at a step function like this, an electrical step function like that, and you do a spectrum analysis of it, you'll find that to get that step, you have all these frequencies. And so we were going in the time domain instead of the frequency domain. You're getting all this right. Anyway, and so it was a radically different way of doing it. And if we'd have been able to pull it off, it would have been really something. So, but it was, you know, state of the art, way out stuff. I haven't been that smart since. So it was when I look back at what we did, it was really amazing.
You feel like that was the most complicated project that you had in your time?
Absolutely, ever. It was. We were doing things faster. You know, we were putting out pulses that were like 5 nanoseconds wide, which was kind of like about as fast as anybody could do anything then. We were in the time domain, we were in the frequency domain, we had an all-digital scope, we had, a 4-bit Intel microprocessor controlling the whole thing. We had another bit slice processor, which was doing the rectangular to polar conversions and Fourier transforms. We had a digital interface that had just come out called the GPIB interface, and I can't remember what the GPIB stands for, but it was a digital interface for controlling instruments. We controlled that with a 4051, which was a tech desktop computer, first personal computer probably ever built before Apple. And it was just, I mean, and other than that little thing about the signal-to-noise ratio, everything worked. Other than that little minor thing that caused us to cancel the project, but so it was just amazing, and it was the team of people that did it. If somebody was to try something like that again, they probably would have had 20 or 30 people. We had like 5 of us. And we had this poor kid I hired from Berkeley as a software engineer, because we had no software engineers at Tech at the time. He did absolutely incredible things, because he didn't know that he couldn't. I mean, he wrote a whole operating system. He wrote all the control. He did all the software. And today you would have 5 or 6 people doing that. But anyway, it was a lot of fun. And very stressful.
Who are the other people on the team?
Ron Peltola, Bill Randall, Glenn Bateman, Ellis Dupuy, Norm Kurth was a software guy. I can't remember his name. I can see his face. That's a long time ago. I can get you his name.
That was 71, is that what you said?
74, 75, something like that. Yeah.
How long have you been at Tektronix at that point?
I started in 69.
Okay. So what came after the most complicated project?
After that, when that sort of wound down, I went down to Wilsonville, which was just starting up, and that was really where all the digital stuff was going on anyway. That's where they were doing the graphics terminals. And I went down there as a design engineer. I had become the engineering manager for this project, the digital network analyzer. And I went back down there, decided I didn't like management, went back down there as a design engineer, got down there and decided I really wasn't that good a design engineer, that I like management a lot better, so I ended up getting into management down there and starting to do work on graphics terminals. And at the time, the Tektronix owned the graphics market. If you wanted to have a computer display with graphics on it, you had to use Tektronix. We absolutely owned the market. And it was based on a proprietary technology called a DVST, which stands for Direct View Storage Tube. And basically what it did, it was a screen, and they were from this size to this size. You electron beam would write, and you got this green image, and it would store it in the phosphor on the CRT. So you could do these very high-resolution, intricate graphs, but if you wanted to change anything, you had to erase the whole thing and start over again. So you every time you drew a new line, it'd go flash. But it was the only game in town. And, you went to Chrysler, Ford, GM. There'd be rooms of our terminals. They designed all their cars that way. I was on a plane in Germany, a Lufthansa plane, and there was an article in there. In their airline magazine showing one of our displays that they'd used to design the plane. So, everybody in the world used our displays. But at that time, there was no color. And there was no, you got green is all you got. So I started working on color projects. There was in order to do color, you need to have storage, and random access memory that's used in computers now is just starting to come online. At that time, you can get chips now that have gigabits on them. At that time, you could get like a chip with 1,000 bits on it. So as that memory got bigger and bigger, it made the color raster scan type products more viable. And so there was actually one of our managers had a graph that showed the price of RAM and at what point it would be cheaper to build the graphics terminal using a RAM-based that anybody could use versus using our storage tube. So we could see that the storage tube was going to die when the RAM price hit that price, and it turned out that way. But we worked on these projects, and so I worked on a product called the 4025 for a while, then I worked on the 4112, and then we started this program. I was given the assignment. I was given a sheet of paper, blank sheet of paper, and it said 4010R. And that's what it said. And they said, here, go do one of these. I said, well, what's that? They said, well, it's a replacement for the 4010, which was our direct view storage thing. And so that was to go replace it with something raster scan, either monochrome or color. And so we started a project called LOCO, which stood for low cost. And, you know, we researched all the different display technologies, the RAM and the cost and all this kind of stuff, and put together I built a team. I had people from manufacturing, from service, from components, sales, marketing, everybody. We put together a team, and we worked for about a year just researching, you know, what we could do for the next terminal. And so we got a new general manager, and he asked me to do a presentation on this. And so I start the presentation, and we were really presenting that we had to move to the raster scan technology away from the direct view storage tube. And at the time, the direct view storage tube, you know, we had a virtual monopoly on the graphics market. And so I get halfway into the presentation, not even half, probably a third, and he says, stop. I don't want to hear any of this about raster scan. I want to keep doing DVSTs.
So you were talking about your presentation.
Okay, so we get in the middle of this presentation, and he says, stop, you know, I don't want to do a raster scan. I'm going to do DVST because, you know, we make 70% gross margin and we own the market. And we tried to explain to him that market was going away, but he didn't want to hear it. So we sort of regrouped, and then we went back again and finally convinced him. And then he hired the current CEO of this company, Jerry Ramey, to start this project to do a color raster scan graphics display. And we codenamed it Unicorn. And that my daughter actually came up with that name. I was home, and I think she was probably about 12 or 13. And I said, you know, we're trying to find a name for this project. Because at the time, Tektronix, everything was, you know, 4010 this and 7000 series this. And we wanted to be different. So we ended up calling it Unicorn. And it probably became one of the most famous projects at Tektronix. We started off, there were like four of us, started this new business unit. And we completely changed the way everything was done. You know, it used to take a Tektronix, you know, 3 to 5 years to get a product out. We did this in a year and a half. We had set new standards in quality. We set new standards in performance, in cost. We set up our own manufacturing line. We did all of the latest, at the time, the Japanese manufacturing, you know, just in time, and what they would call now lean. Or total quality management. We applied all of that stuff, and we just had this terrific project. I mean, we hit every milestone. We made so much money we didn't know what to do with it. We probably did, I think I'd heard, close to $100 million in sales the first full year of business. We just hit the market at the right time with the right product, and it just went, you know, it was huge. And that division, I think, ended up about $250 to $300 million in business. So it was a huge deal, and it was a great project. It was a great team. You know, the fact that I'm here now is because Jerry's here. So, and there's probably five other people from the Unicorn team here. So, and it was one of those projects that you get once in a lifetime where everything went right. It was just amazing.
You mentioned the term total quality management.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
That was really looking at the total cost. There was a guy named Phil Crosby. There were like three gurus of quality around that time: Duran, Deming, and Crosby. We brought Crosby in to talk about total quality management, and what it means is looking at the total cost, the kind of the life cycle cost of a product. So, you know, you can make a product that has no failures in the field, let's say, but if you spend, you know, $100 million to do that and you don't get any return on it, then so what that it doesn't fail in the field. So it's looking at, you know, how do you design a product so that you get good return on investment, but you meet the requirements of the customer. So, and you look at all of the costs. You know, you look at service costs. You know, we for example, at that time, Tektronix, if a product had a keyboard, they would part number every component on that keyboard, every keycap, every spring, every screw, everything. And if a customer had a failure, they'd send the keyboard back and somebody would repair it. What we did is we said, we're going to make the keyboard so inexpensive, just throw it away, so you don't have all that service cost. So we did that. And actually, we got the service costs down so low that the service department ended up losing a lot of money because we told them that they were not going to have to service this product, and they didn't believe us, and so they part numbered all this stuff. Well, nothing failed because we did such a good job of looking at all the quality aspects. I mean, we had a reliability quality engineer that could take temperature measurements on a circuit board on integrated circuits, and failure rates of integrated circuits is based on the junction temperature of the transistors that are in that integrated circuit. So he would measure the temperature of each of the integrated circuits on that board, and he could predict mathematically what the failure rate would be. And he would come to us and say, if you want to increase the mean time between failures from 1,000 to, say, 1,400 hours, you need to lower the temperature of this integrated circuit by 5 degrees. And so we would readjust the airflow and the fans and stuff like that and get that down. So we ended up with an MTBF of, I think, 14,000 hours on that product, where typical tech at the time was 2,000 to 2,000 hours. So it's looking at those things. It's looking at, you know, if you have scrap. You know, we didn't have this problem, but there was a case when I was down at Wilsonville where we were having really big rejects on this keyboard that we were building. And so I went over to manufacturing and watched them put one of these keyboards together. Well, there was a lady there with a big rubber hammer, and she'd get the keyboard, the actual keys, and then there was a metal case that went around it. Well, the case wasn't designed properly, so she had to pound on it with a hammer. Well, 1 out of 3 times she'd bend it and throw it away. So that's where we're having rejects. So when you're looking at total quality, you look at that and say, well, how do we fix that? Well, you redesign it. So she doesn't have to hit it with a hammer and get the reject. So that's kind of the principle of it. But you look at the whole aspect of the product. Did that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So I want to backtrack a little bit and ask, okay, how did you come into a managerial position?
The first one was on the digital network analyzer. That's a good question. I think it's because I, you know, when I look back on my life, I've always been sort of a project manager. You know, from third grade on, I can go back and look at projects that I did. And so I like to organize things, and I think it was that, because I was organizing things and laying out schedules, and it's sort of like, oh, well, why don't you be the manager? So I think that's kind of how it started.
Mm-hmm. What led you to decide you didn't like it?
Oh, management?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the stress on that digital network analyzer. It was tremendous because we put a lot of money into it, and the guy that thought it up was one of these really, really committed tech engineers that he wouldn't give up on it, and he was very upset with us. He didn't think we worked hard enough. He didn't think we, you know, thought of enough things. But we had worked and tried and done everything we could. There was a lot of visibility at the board level. I mean, we made presentations to Howard Vollum and the board, and you know, my boss would say everything's going fine, even though I'd been telling him it hadn't. And so it was just very, very stressful. And I thought, you know, I just don't want to deal with this. I just want to, you know, go work on my little state diagrams, do my little digital stuff. But so, I mean, I think that's kind of how I got into it. I think it was sort of, I mean, it's who I am. I'm an organized, I organize things. And, you know, I used to organize pep rallies at school and dances. And I just, that's what I do, you know, so.
So once you became an engineer, you missed that, the ability to organize people?
Well, I think I still did it. You know, I mean, that's what I did. You know, when I was working on a project, I would lay out schedules and I would, you know, divide up work and sort of ask people, you know. And project management wasn't a real career at that time. So it was, you know, kind of like you go into engineering and, you know, if you want to do that, go ahead. People would do it. But.
And what came after Unicorn?
Well, after Unicorn, that was when, startup fever was hitting the Washington County. You know, people, Tom Bergere and Jerry Langler had spun out of Tektronix to form a mentor. Gene Chow had spun out to form Metheus. People at Intel had spun out to form Sequent, and there was just money flowing in. Anybody that wanted to leave Tektronix or Intel could get funding to start a company. And so I got hooked up with this company called eMachines, which was started by two of Howard Vollum's sons, Larry Vollum and Steve Vollum. And at the time, the Macintosh was this little thing. You've seen the little early ones? They didn't have a big display, so we built big displays for them. And, oh, wait a minute, I missed something. There was something after Unicorn. There was AIM. I should back up, because that was an interesting one, too. While I was part of the Unicorn group, I was approached by some guys from Tech Labs about this idea of a workstation based around a language called Smalltalk, which is an object-oriented language, which was a precursor to everything that Apple does. It was the first programming language that had Windows and a mouse, and, you know, click on Windows and open things. It came out of Xerox PARC, which was their research lab. So they had approached me about starting a business around that. And so I said, okay, that sounds really interesting. It was really what they had up in Tech Labs is they developed workstations. You familiar with Sun Microsystems? They were the first company to build workstations, which were basically computers with displays. And became very big and made a lot of people very rich. But Tech Labs had a similar product working in their labs several years before they came out with this. And what they wanted to do was productize that. So they asked me if I would help lead that. And so through a bunch of stuff, we ended up getting funding for that from the board of directors to start a business around that. And at the time, there was another group at Wilsonville doing workstations that didn't want us to do that. So we had some influence with the board, so we got the board to basically approve us to do this little startup. So we took what they had in Tech Labs, and in order to get permission to do it, we had to reposition it. We couldn't make it, it couldn't be a workstation. We had to call it something else, so we called it an artificial intelligence machine. And we put some, at the time, there were several programming languages that people were using to do artificial intelligence. There was Lisp and Prolog. So we built this workstation, and we called it AIM for Artificial Intelligence Machines, and we put Smalltalk on it, we put Lisp on it, Prolog, and took it out to market. But it turned out that it was a technology looking for a market. There was no market. I mean, we sold We sold a lot of them. We sold probably, I think we got up to $6 or $7 million in sales, but it was just people buying one to see what it was because they were curious. But so that kind of, you know, it reached a point where we could see that that wasn't going to be viable. So we closed that down, and then I, so I was a general manager. That was a new business unit, and then I became director of advanced product development, just a small group of people doing research on new stuff, and that was kind of not going anywhere. So this eMachines asked me if I'd like to come and be the chief operating officer. So I left, went there. And that was interesting because I was able to use a lot of the training I just got from Tektronix. I haven't really gone talked about the kind of training that Tektronix had, but they had amazing training. From the time you become a manager to the time you're like a general manager, they had quarterly programs. So I was probably in, you know, a week, a quarter, most of my career as a manager at Tektronix, I'd be in some kind of training. And this was really state-of-the-art, top management people from around the country. You know, whoever had written the latest book that everybody was reading, you know, Tom Peters, Michael Porter, you know, going clear back to early guys in the 50s and 60s. So really, really good training. So I was able to take all that training and really apply it immediately at eMachines, especially around marketing and financial planning. The problem with eMachines was sooner or later Apple was going to create a big display of their own, you know. And there were four companies at the time that were doing big displays for the Macintoshes. Radius, Supermac, something, and eMachines. We were kind of all the same level. And we were using Sony displays, and became clear after a while that sooner or later, either Apple or Sony was just going to take that market. And we reached a point where they started to do that, and we couldn't figure out how to reposition the business. And then the Steve Vollum hired a turnaround guy to come in and fix the company. And the first thing turnaround guys do is they fire all the executives. So I was out the door from there. That was after about 2.5 years or something.
And what year did you leave Tektronix to go to eMachines?
Would have been 1987. And then I was at eMachines for about 2.5 years, I think, till we got tossed out of there. Mm-hmm. And then I went to work for InFocus. I was hired as VP of Engineering. That was a tech connection. I mean, all these are tech connections, you know. I mean, all the people at eMachines were from Tektronix, and all the people at InFocus were from either Tektronix or Planar, and Planar was from Tektronix. So it was, you know, people I knew at InFocus found out it was available and called me up, and I went down to interview there and became vice president of engineering there. And we did some really fun things there. We did a, I think I was there about 3 years. Left there in 93. So it's kind of like 90 to 93, something like that. We got behind. It was like being at Tektronix all over again with a storage tube. We had this, there's a good management article called, oh my God, mental blank, my favorite management article. Well, maybe it'll come to me one of these days. But
do you remember the author's name?
No. I carry it with me everywhere and do it, but it Marketing Myopia, by Theodore Levitt, which basically says, you know, decide what business you're in. And in the case of Tektronix, with the graphics, with the DVST, we talked about being in the graphics business, but we acted like we were in the DVST business, which prevented us from going to the different technologies. So we were so hung up on our own technology that we didn't see these other technologies coming along that were going to take our market away, which they eventually did.
And you're talking about InFocus or Tektronix?
Well, Tektronix, but okay. It applies to InFocus. What's interesting is it applies to InFocus, too. So Tektronix, it was a storage tube, which is our proprietary technology that only we could do. We had this whole factory. I mean, basically, sand went in one end and CRTs came out the other. And we had gross margins, 70% gross margins. We were making tons of money. We had a monopoly in the market. But here's this other technology that's coming along. And because we said we were in the graphics business, but the way we behaved was we were in the storage tube business because we didn't look for other alternatives for displaying graphics like raster scan and some other things that other people developed and eventually took away the whole market for Tektronix. Get to InFocus, it's the same thing. They've got this proprietary technology. And when InFocus started, what they made was a little box about this size that had an LCD in it, and you set it on a standard overhead projector and hooked it up to your computer, and then it would project. And it was a proprietary technology. And they developed a way of using that technology to do color. So they were the only, it was like tech all over again, they were the only people that could do color projection. And they did an initial public offering on that, made everybody rich, everybody except me and other people. But the founders made a lot of money on it. But then this other technology that the Japanese were developing that is what basically is in flat panel TVs now, TFT technology, LCD technology, was coming along, and we could see it. But our CEO, the founder of InFocus, he was really wanted to stick with this proprietary technology, and so we got behind. And our competitors are starting to do stuff with this TFT. So we got kind of in this crisis mode. So one day he called me into his office and said, he listed five products. And he said, I want these five, this was in August. He said, I want these five products to show at the Infocom, which was a big projector trade show, in January. And I want them shipping by February, which was like 6 months, 5.5 months. And he said, what do you need to do it? And so I told him, I said, well, okay. He wouldn't let me leave the room until I made a commitment to do it. So I said, I need this, and I need this budget, and I need this engineer, and I need that. And we went off and we created this whole program around it called Days of Thunder. And we set up stock options. Everybody in the company got stock options based on the success of this program. So, I mean, from the receptionist on up, except the managers, we didn't get any stock options, but everybody got stock options. And we had these five products we had to get done, and there was a certain percentage of stock that you got for each one that was completed, and then a 10% kicker if we did all five. And we did it. I mean, we pulled it off. It was really cool. And, we had all kinds of deducts. We had Days of Thunder cups and pencils and little cars and all kinds. Every week somebody would bring something in. It was just a real blast, and it was really fun to go to Infocom with five new products when our competitors were putting out one. It was the second greatest project after Unicorn. So, but that was a fun thing. But then we got a new CEO, and I did not get along, and he eventually ended up firing me. So that was about 6 months after we finished Days of Thunder. So then I went to work for a company called Instantiations, which was a spin-off from Tektronix. The software people from the old AIM group had started a company called Instantiations that had been sold to a company called Digitalk. And so I went to them, worked for them for a while, running their software consulting business. And I was there about 2 years, maybe. But I got frustrated with the way things were going there. And so a kid that my son had gone to school with recruited me to be the CEO of a company called Systematics Design International, which did software for automating wafer fabs. Made contracts with LSI Logic and several Taiwanese companies that were building wafer fabs for doing integrated circuits. So that was an even more interesting experience because our CEO, or the owner of the company, was constitutionally incapable of doing a straight deal. I mean, everything had to have side deals and under the table stuff, and it was bizarre because we had contracts with companies that would, he'd get a contract and then we'd be and then he'd take the money from that contract and use it to fund another project. And it got to the point where this one company actually sent people into our offices to sit and make sure all the engineers were working on their projects. And if we wanted to leave to go talk to somebody else, we'd do these, you know, we'd have somebody call in and say, your wife's sick, you gotta come home right away. So we did a lot of that. So that, and then we were always short of cash. Had to miss payroll several times, and when we missed payroll, he was always out of town, and I had to talk to the employees. So, but you know, I learned a lot from that. That you know, if you're honest with people, they'll stick with you. You know, we just go to the employees and we say, you know, I'd say, here's how much cash we got. Here's what I can pay you this week. You know, if you've got a house payment or something, you know, we've held back this cash, but we can't give you a paycheck till 2 weeks from now. And here's the check that's supposed to be coming in from this customer. Here's the one that's coming in from this customer. You know, as long as we explained it to people, they were good with it. We always made it within a couple of weeks. And I also learned that and this lady that I worked with at Tektronix had told me that with your vendors, if you are going to have a problem paying them, you should go to them first. Don't let them come to you and say you're late. So I practiced that, and I go to the people that we owed money, and I would tell them the same thing. I'd say, you know, here's our position. You know, I don't have anything to pay you. But I'd say, we're going to get check here, check here, check there. I can pay you this much, and then, and meet that. And we only had one person take us to collections, which is also an interesting experience because the guy called me up, and I don't know if you've ever been called by a collection agent, but, you know, they yell at you, and they swear at you, and they threaten you, and they're like, yeah, there's money right now. And I said, well, I don't have any money. He doesn't know what to say to that. And I said, I have no money. You know, there's no money. So, but that was kind of interesting. So, and then from there, I had been, there was another spinoff company called Home Row, which is a spinoff from Tektronix, that made a pointing device for keyboards. I don't know if you've seen the IBM keyboards with the little mouse thing in the center of the keyboard. Well, we made a device like that. Yeah. They had developed a thing that actually, they had actually built it into a key. So they put it into the Home Row keys on the keyboard, hence the name Home Row. So you didn't have that little pointy thing, but you had a key that actually did that. So you could hit that key and move the mouse around. And the guy that started the company, I mean, he's just typing along like that and going like that, and the cursors were jumping all over the place, and you think, wow, that's really cool. He'd asked me to be on the board of directors, so I was on the board of directors, and they were not doing well. So the guy that owned the company, when I got ready to leave SDI, he hired me as CEO of that company. I guess the interesting thing there was when I got there, I did a few spreadsheets and proved to myself that there was no possible way it would ever be a viable business. And went to the guy that owned the company, but he didn't want to shut it down. He wanted to keep trying, so we tried for another 2 years, I think, before I finally convinced him to shut it down. He put a lot of money into it. He was a really good guy. But so we downsized it. We'd been running at about $100,000 a month run rate, and we downsized it to about $25,000, which is something he could maintain for a while. And ended up selling it to a Chinese company. Mm. And where did I go from there? Then I went to a spinoff of InFocus called Lightwear, which made projectors, as VP of engineering. It was a bunch of people I'd worked with at InFocus. And they had developed the world's smallest, lightest projector. And it was a little about that big. You know, you get them this big now, but at the time, the last projector I did in focus was probably about that long, and about that wide, and about that deep. And they had developed this one that was probably a third that size. Had venture capital funding. And so I was hired to develop this new product that was based around a Sony LCD that they were in the process of developing. I was hired to do that. And the month after I got there, Sony announced a year delay in the LCD. So we didn't know quite what to do because we hired all these engineers. So we did a conventional projector. This one we were going to do, it was called Beetle. That was a code name. And it was going to be probably, you know, this big, very small, so half the size of the smallest. It would have been the smallest, lightest projector in the world. But it all depended on this Sony LCD. And so they delayed it a year. So we had all these resources. So we did kind of a conventional projector that was kind of a me-too that just really didn't do much of anything. There's nothing special about it while we were waiting for Sony for this LCD. And when they finally did get the LCD to production level, it didn't work as advertised. And so we tried to build a projector around it, but it just didn't have the performance it needed. So it was, and then, so I laid myself off and half the engineers and left there. And that company eventually got split up and sold, but, you know, they never were able to get the projector out because we'd bet the whole farm on that particular technology. And that's kind of the story of a lot of high-tech stuff. You know, you get this technology and you think it's going to work, and sometimes it doesn't. So, and then from there, I got a consulting gig at Planar Systems, which is another spinoff of Tektronix, but through another connection I had. The HR manager, VP there, was a lady I knew from Tektronix. This is all, I mean, Tektronix is just everywhere, you know, so you can hardly go into a place and not run into somebody. But so I consulted with them for about 3 months, and then they hired me to be the engineering manager for the medical business unit. And I did that for a couple of years. And then they bought another medical company back in Boston. And they wanted me to go back to Boston. And I said, I'm not going to Boston. So I ended up, you know, laying myself off from there. And right after that, then I started a consulting business. I did that for a while. Did some consulting with a few display companies around town. And then this opportunity came along. I'd always been interested in nonprofits, and, you know, I'd volunteered a lot in schools and done stuff like that. But there was an organization called the... is that you? So they bought this company in Boston. I already said that, didn't I? Yeah, they bought that. So I left there and consulted. Okay, I said that. And then there's an organization called the Entrepreneurs Foundation that was started in the Bay Area by venture capitalists. And the idea was, you know, how do you get a community service, community involvement program going in startup companies? Because everybody is busy. They have no money. So these venture capitalists started this organization, and what they did, they'd go to startup companies and say, okay, set aside 3% of your stock to the Entrepreneurs Foundation with the idea that when you go public or you sell a company, you cash that stock in and you've got a foundation. You know, we'll use that and we'll start a foundation for the company. So started in the Bay Area, they probably had 150 companies that belonged to it. And there's all kinds of studies about why community involvement is good for companies and stuff like that. And allowed these startup companies to say, hey, you know, we are committed to the community. We've set aside the stock. And if we're successful, all that money is going to come back to the community in terms of a foundation that will donate whatever. So anyway, they had a chapter up here that had been here for about 3 years. And the guy who was retiring was head of that. And I heard about it through a friend of mine and thought, Whoa, that sounds like very interesting, because I've always liked networking and finding out what's going on. So I applied for that and ended up getting that, and did that half-time for 3.5 years. And we ended up having about 1.6 million shares of stock of various companies, startup companies around Portland. But the problem was that was a time when the IPO market dried up, so nobody was going public. And our whole funding model was based on, when I was hired, we had stock in this company called Tripwire that was supposed to go public that year, and we were going to get, our cut of it was going to be about $100,000, which would cover our operating budget for a couple of years. But they didn't go, and we had all this stock in these great companies, but the IPO market was just dead, so we had no funding source. So we ended up trying to figure out a different model. So, we tried, just getting contributions, but that didn't work. And so we ended up coming up with this idea of basically outsourcing community involvement for small companies. So let's say you've got your small company and you want to do something in Habitat for Humanity, or you want to do a blood drive, we would set that up for you. So we would set up programs and then for our member companies, and I think at our peak we had about 50 companies that belonged to it. We would set up Habitat for Humanity days. So we'd go out to all of our little companies and say, hey, we've got 50 slots at Habitat for Humanity. Come and we'll take care of it. We'll provide the donuts, all that kind of stuff. We did that. We did schoolhouse supplies, backpack programs. We did Rebuilding Portland Together, some other things like that. And then we offered companies that didn't have stock, for a fee per year, we'll take care of all your community involvement. We'll help you set up matching giving programs. We'll give you best practices from all these different companies. Basically, we'll just take care of all your community involvement, because people were busy. And at the time, and I think it's still the case, employees are expecting that of the company they work for. And a lot of our companies would advertise on their website, hey, we're a member of the Entrepreneurs Foundation, and we give this back to the community. So it had a lot of value, but we just couldn't get enough companies to pay for it. And so it ended up, we ended up having to downsize that because we just basically ran out of money. And it eventually got merged into the Oregon Entrepreneurs Network, and you're familiar with them, but it's a subgroup of that now. And they probably just made a lot of money because Tripwire got sold, and Jive Software, I don't know if you heard of them, they just went public for $1 billion, and we had like 100,000 shares of stock in them. So I think it just took a lot longer than we thought for something to happen. So I did that, and then I was going to retire. And I'd been in touch with Jerry here at Lightspeed I just sort of followed the company. This company's about 20 years old. He founded it after he left Tektronix. So every 3 or 4 years I'd have lunch with him and see what's going on. And so he called me up and asked if I knew anybody who would like to do some project management stuff. And I said, well, yeah, I would. So I came down and did some project management work for them for about 3 months, and then they wanted to hire me as a project manager. I said, no, I don't want to be a project manager. I'm retiring. So then they offered me vice president of engineering and stock and stuff. And I said, oh, okay. So I've been here about 3 years. And it's great. This is the greatest company I've ever worked for. It's just an amazing company. And we do audio stuff for K-12 classrooms. So that's kind of it.
So I want to backtrack and ask a question about Tektronix really quickly. A lot of readings that I've done sort of describe Tektronix as having a very family-like atmosphere, and that people were very close to their coworkers in the work environment and outside of the work environment. And did you experience that, or did your coworkers experience that?
Oh yeah, Almost all of my best friends are from people I work with at Tektronix, and we're all close. We all stay in touch. I hear from people I just you know, Xerox bought Wilsonville. I just heard, you know, every time there's a layoff somewhere, I get calls. They just had a big layoff. They laid off 120 people a couple of weeks ago. We're all very close. We have we have about every 5 years we have a reunion. We got one coming up in April. It's very tight community. It was just an amazing company. I mean, the training I've talked about, which is just, I got probably the equivalent of 3 MBAs being there, and not, you know, I mean, from top people. I mean, you name anybody that wrote a book in management, and they were there teaching the class. So you know, we had I had a program when I first became a manager to teach you how to be a manager, and then they had a mid-management forum, and then they had a manager forum, and it was very in-depth, and you know, like week-long sessions, very intense. So, you know, that built a lot of talent for this area, and I don't know that anybody's doing that anymore. Intel might still be. I don't know. I don't really know anybody in Intel anymore, but. And there was that, and you could ask people to do anything. There's stories about people, you know, coming in off the street and asking, somebody at Tektronix or anybody did printing, and they said, oh yeah, we do printing, and print something off for them for free, you know, just kind of stuff like that. It was just very open, friendly, almost naive from a business standpoint, but did very well. Yeah, we got up to $1.4 billion. So, and when I was there, we had 25,000 employees. So it was an amazing company. But yeah, there were politics and ugliness, like whenever you have more than one person together. but it was generally good. And the opportunity just to move around and do what you want. You know, I got to do things that, you know, I got to start my own business there. I got to do, you know, I ran manufacturing for a while. Got to go to Columbia University for a week-long course in marketing. I got to be the account executive for Chrysler. I got to go back. I saw the first minivan before it came off the line.
Did you buy one?
No. My kids were old enough that by then I didn't have to, so. But yeah, I mean, it was, and people were very proud to be there because you could go. I remember going to Toshiba's world headquarters in Tokyo, meeting with one of their senior vice presidents, and the first thing he told me, and I'm not even that high up in Tektronix, but, you know, we got to meet with those kind of people because it opened doors, and first thing he said was, we don't design anything without Tektronix oscilloscopes, you know. So, and just seeing that, and, you know, you could go. I traveled in France, Germany, all over Europe, Japan. Tektronix was a huge deal. You know, mm-hmm. We could go anywhere.
Did you ever have that feeling again when you were working?
No. Mm-hmm. No, I've never been in a company that had that kind of clout mm-hmm. and that kind of reputation. I mean, Lightspeed has got a reputation every bit as good as Tektronix, and probably better in some senses, but nobody in Portland's ever even heard of us. You know, I mean, I knew about it, but I tell people in Lightspeed, what's Lightspeed? You know, nobody knows, but everybody knew Tektronix. I mean, even my parents down in Ashland, they didn't know anything about anything, knew about Tektronix. So it was cool. Mm-hmm. It was a great experience. Anybody that worked there will tell you that. Not so much anymore.
People that work there now, you mean?
It's awful now.
Really?
Yeah.
What caused that?
They got sold.
Oh, right.
Yeah. It was, I think it was kind of going downhill a little after that, you know, after Howard died.
Yeah.
Some of the old guard left, so.
Mm-hmm. But. When that management transition was happening, was that around the time that you left?
Howard died when I was right about the time I went down to Wilsonville. And mm-hmm. then Earl Wantland was president, and then he was replaced with Dave Friedley, I think, and then Velsink. So I was there for Friedley and Velsink. And then I left. I think Wim might have been the president then. And then after that was Jerry Meyer. And then it really changed because all those other people were inside tech people. He came from the Midwest and brought a totally different culture. Yeah. So.
What was that? What culture from the Midwest?
Suits, white shirts, ties, formal, golf. You know.
So then it's fair to say while you were at Tektronix, it was a little more relaxed.
It was very relaxed, mm-hmm. Yeah. It was very informal. Everybody was on a first name basis, you know. You could go up to, you could walk up to Howard, you could walk up, they had open offices in Building 50. Mm-hmm. You know, go up there, Howard's sitting there, Bill Walker's sitting there, Larry Mee is sitting there, they're all sitting there, you know, you could talk to them, they'd talk to you.
Yeah.
You know, Howard would come around and wander around, look at things, and kind of know what's going on. And so, yeah, it was good. And we had, we celebrated things, you know, we finished a project, we'd have celebrations. A friend of mine that was another engineering manager down there, we used to have contests to see who could spend the most on pizza for milestone parties, you know. We had an engineering release for a product, that's when the engineering's finished, and there's a manufacturing, we had big parties, big celebrations. And then on Unicorn, we had a celebration of all celebrations. So, yeah, we rented the Marriott and had a huge, huge party because it was a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You mentioned the companies you worked for, they wanted you to move to Boston, but you really didn't want to move to Boston. Is there a reason that you wanted to stay in Oregon?
I would never leave Oregon.
Really?
No.
Why
for
not?
Anything. I love it.
Yeah.
I grew up here.
Yeah.
I grew up in Ashland. My friends are all here. I couldn't leave my friends. So, and, you know, I've been to the East Coast. I've traveled all over for Tektronix and other companies, and I've just never found a better place to live.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Well, one place. Helsinki.
Really?
Yeah. When I was at Planar, we had a plant in Helsinki, and I had an engineering group there, so I got to travel there a few times. Very nice. Little town, kind of Portland, like smaller than Portland,
mm-hmm.
And you can ride around the whole town in an hour on a bicycle.
Mm-hmm. Was community involvement important to Tektronix, do you think?
It was. You know, I did, when did I start getting involved in stuff? Yeah, I did stuff. I did stuff when I was at Tektronix. That's when I first started getting involved. Yeah, they encouraged it. I mean, it wasn't overtly. It was like, if you want to do that, well, that's great. You know, go do it. You know. So I got involved in, you know, education. The lady that was one of our marketing managers at Unicorn went to work for Portland Public Schools, and she recruited me as a volunteer to work there.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of got me started in that, and I'm still doing that kind of stuff. So,
what kind of volunteer work?
Right now I'm on the board of directors of Portland Community College.
Okay.
I'm on the board of directors of MESA, which is part of Portland State. You familiar with MESA? Math, Engineering, Science, Achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm on the board of an organization called Moyojasiri, which is started by the lady that I worked with at Entrepreneurs Foundation, our mission is to promote entrepreneurship in low-income women around the world. So we basically work, we've got a program going here in Portland and one in Kenya, teach women basic entrepreneurship skills,
mm-hmm.
You know, business management, finance, stuff like that, and then help them get funding, help them create a business plan, help them get funding, and then hook them up with a mentor or two here in the States to kind of advise them as they go along. So,
mm-hmm. Did you feel like there was a big divide between your work life and your home life? I mean, were you often working on projects at home, or?
No, not too much. You know, there were a few times. Well, I mean, there were times when we had to work long hours, but you know, tech was not intense like maybe someplace in the Bay Area. You know, one of the things that venture capitalists say about Portland is that there's not that intensity, you know, that people like to have a balanced life, and that's not what they're looking mm-hmm. for. They want people that are going to, you know, work 24 hours a day, and that's just not the style in Portland, and that's not why people are here. Mm-hmm. So.
What did you like to do outside of work?
Well, I had three kids, so I did that. Did soccer. I don't know how we did that, you know, soccer, three stuff every weekend. We barely get anything done on weekends now. But. So I had kids, and, you know, I hunted and mountain climbed and bicycled. I'd done cycle rigging a number of times, and then got involved in mountain climbing through a guy I worked with at Tektronix and did that. I couldn't do that anymore. And, play guitar, stuff like that. A bunch of us from Tektronix still get together. We had a band.
Really?
Wilsonville. Wilsonville was called the Information Display Division, IDD. We had a band called the Id Pickers, a bluegrass band. So
did you play publicly?
We did.
Yeah?
We did. We actually did. I think we might have had one or two paying gigs, but we weren't good enough to have playing gigs. Well, there were a couple of guys in our band that were really good, but they were professionals, but mm-hmm. I never was. So we still get together. There's a bunch of us from Tech that still get together in just somebody's house and play and sing and make noise.
Yeah, sounds fun. So, are you thinking about retiring soon then?
I'm going to retire in July.
Mm-hmm. That's really exciting.
Yeah. Congratulations. So I'm half-time now, so.
Okay. So as you're sort of winding down your career, are you thinking about what constitutes your legacy? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Oh, that's a hard one. Wow. Well, I'd like to think that I've hired good people and given them opportunities to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So I've, the people I work with have generally been successful. I don't know if I have anything to do with it, but, you know, some of them I've hired, some of them I've mentored. You know, I still, whenever there's layoffs or something, I hear from people. And so I like to connect people.
Mm-hmm.
Network and, you know, do reference and stuff like that. So, it's just like, I guess it would be, that I treated people well, gave them opportunities, and helped them get to wherever they wanted to go.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there anything you want to add? Any anecdotes? Or?
Oh, I got lots of anecdotes.
Lots of anecdotes?
We haven't even talked about the lawsuits.
Oh, wow. Well, is there anything, any stories you want to tell or anything you can think of that I might have left out?
See if I can think of any good stories. I usually have lots of stories.
But yeah.
I'm getting to that age, you know, I think I'm probably this old doddering man repeating the same stories over and again. So, but I always, all my points, I always have a, you know, if you've done this long enough, you've sort of got a story to go with any sort of point you want to make, so I have lots of those, but I'm trying to think if there's anything really good. Well, there's the when we were doing a projector at InFocus, when the CEO, we were demonstrating for him at one of the milestone meetings, that caught fire. That was interesting.
Oh.
See, I've been sued for libel, been a friend. Patent infringement lawsuit. Testified before Congress a couple of times on education stuff.
Was that linked to your volunteer work, or was that for?
Yeah, that was on. I was on the board of. When I that lady that recruited me for schoolwork, it was when the. I worked at Roosevelt High School, and we created a, they were trying to reform the high school, and so I was kind of the business advisor and actually brought in this project management guru that I had used, and he offered a free course to all the faculty and teachers there. And we created a project called the Roosevelt Renaissance 2000, which was a 10-year plan for reforming the school around clusters. The idea was to have career paths, so there was like a natural resources career path and a I don't even remember what they were. There was a health services career path, so it broke into six career paths, and that was when school to work was really the big thing. And so we created this whole program. We hired this guy from Nabisco that came in and set up this whole internship program, and we set out some pretty lofty goals. You know, we said we want 100% of the kids every year to go out on some kind of work experience, because we said, you know, we really need to connect to create relevance and get these kids in the workplace to see the relevance of what they're learning in school. So this guy named Rene Leger set up this really good program where we actually got almost 100% of the kids out every year, which is a huge undertaking. You would start off in freshman year with maybe just a couple hour job shadow, and then it would progressively go up till when you're a senior, you might have a summer gig, you know, and raised, I don't know, $6 million in grants and stuff like that. We got national recognition. And then school of work fell out of favor. The administration changed. The money dried up. And it sort of just like went away. So that was 10 years. It was kind of sad to see that. But that's one of the things I've seen about education reform is that there's so much momentum in the system or inelasticity in the system is that you can kind of stretch it here and you can kind of stretch it there, but if you can't stretch it and hold it long enough, it's going to just pop back to the way it was. And that program that we spent so much time on, once Rene left, it was gone within 2 years. So it was, you know, a nationally recognized program. And then, so I think that was probably when I did some testimony. And then I was on the board of Work Systems, Inc., which was a, there's a national organization of workforce investment boards. There's the Workforce Investment Act, which is a national labor law that puts money out into communities for workforce development. So these WIBs are, there's, I don't know, there's 8 or 9 regions in Oregon have these workforce investment boards. So I got on that board, and we had like $27 million budget to distribute in the Portland area for doing workforce investment. And we had a lot of grants, and I got involved in a libel lawsuit because I recommended they fire one of the people there. He sued us, but they took care of it. And I was in I've been in a couple of patent lawsuits.
At the various startups, or?
Yeah, one was, the first one I was in was, remember I mentioned Home Row?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the guy that invested in that was invested in another company called Prio, which made, it was another spinoff from Tektronix that made a test system for creating glasses to help you view your computer better. Anyway, and the guy that started it had hired this sales guy and promised him 50% of the profits, which was a ridiculous sort of proposition to make. And so when this guy that invested in Home Row, I introduced him to the Prio people. He wanted to invest in that, and he said, I won't invest if you got that kind of deal with the sales guy. So the founder fired the sales guy sued us. So I got, that was my first trial. So I got, had to do a deposition, and then we went down to downtown, and, you know, there was a judge and a lawyer, and their lawyer tried to get me declared a hostile witness, and the judge says, well, he doesn't seem hostile at all, you know. But that was like, it was like being on Perry Mason, you know. And then the other one was, well, actually it was Home Row, which was the other company we got sued It was a patent infringement suit. And that was like Perry Mason, too. Our lawyer just took this other lawyer, just took him to pieces. It was down in Los Angeles, and I went down and he just took him to pieces. And we ended up proving that they had forged a document that they had presented to the judge. And our lawyer, from Marjorie Johnson, which is a patent attorney here in town, found a forensic something or other down in Corvallis that looked at this document and said that they'd taken a black marker and drawn a line on it to make it look, so it looked like ours. And they were able to prove that. And so the whole thing was thrown out, and they had to pay all our legal expenses, which was like $100,000.
Wow.
That was kind of fun.
Yeah.
Not at the time, but fortunately our owner had deep pockets and he was able to fund that, but they would have put us out of business if we'd have been a normal company.
Was that one of the bigger challenges in your career?
No, because we had a lawyer that just took care of it, you know, and he had money. So things are easy when you have money, or you've got an investor that's got money. It's when you're out of money.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the hardest, well, systematic design, where I had to, you know, tell people they weren't going to get paid, that was probably the hardest, because I spent my days just staring at spreadsheets trying to figure out where I was going to get the money to make payroll and pay off our vendors, you know. It was just constant. That was constant stress. That was probably the most stressful job. Anyway.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add?
Not that I can think of.
Okay.
Do you have any more questions?
I have tons of questions, but but it's getting to be about 4.
Okay. All right. All right. So this is all our products that go down this way and go out that door down there.
Uh-huh.
We ship pretty much around the world.
Wow.
This right here is a thing he's holding, it's called a Red Cat.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a little flat panel speaker. You know, an infrared microphone you wear, and it sits in the back of the room. The teacher uses the microphone. And basically what it gives you a completely uniform sound throughout the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So every kid hears the sound. And it's designed for speech intelligibility, so they actually hear better. They hear words better than they would just through normal voice.
Uh-huh.
So this is an older version of the same thing here.
Okay.
This is a bigger version. So it's basically, this is the speaker. It's a flat panel speaker. And what's unique about it is that a normal speaker is cone-shaped. And it puts out sound like that.
Mm-hmm.
This puts out sound 180 degrees. So if that was on, if you're standing here, you would hear it the same as if you were in the front of it. So everybody hears the same.
Mm-hmm.
If you have like 4 speakers in the ceiling, you've got dead spots where the cones come down.
Mm-hmm.
Does
that make sense? What inspired the founders to start this company?
Well,
were they involved in education?
Jerry is this amazing guy. He just starts companies. You know, he started Long Bottom Coffee. He started a pasta business. He started a candle business. They were doing pro audio stuff and not really making anywhere. And he found this study that somebody had done. They were trying to see if amplification in a classroom would help students with hearing disabilities perform better.
Oh, okay.
And so they did it, and what they discovered was that everybody did better. So there's all kinds of studies. If you go to our website, there's like pages and pages of studies.
Yeah, I was really curious about that. Just, you know, how they conducted the studies, because I just find that really fascinating. You know, how you could sort of like quantify how people do better once there's more intelligibility. And
yeah, well, I think it's just basically on, you know, test scores. And we've done a lot of research projects where we'll do, you know, classroom in, classroom out. And it's been going on. So this started 20 years ago, so there's a lot of studies.
Yeah.
And then recently we've done there's a software system called Lena.
Yeah.
That somehow, and I haven't read the paper on it, it just came out, we just finished it. We had an audiologist that did this test. He took our red cat, and this system will tell you the intelligibility of words. So it will tell you, based on the sounds that it hears, how many words a student will hear clearly. And we're able to show that ours, on a typical day, a student will hear 500 more words clearly with a red cat than they would with just normal voice.
Wow.
So, and I don't understand all the technology, and I haven't looked at the paper, but that's pretty amazing. And we've got, now, you know what? The service department in here. But anyway, I mean, how do you hear this thing? You just go nuts when you hear it. We have a program. This is our.
Oh,
engineer.
Okay.
I have it down there. I don't know if it's working, so I'll show you. The top secret in the system. I'll have to kill you.
Okay. All right.
It's basically... This is the newest red cat that we just introduced.
Okay.
Plug it in.
And
be a quick demo.
So you mentioned that you ship them all over the world. Where would you say, I mean, where has this product been most popular?
Well, there are 400 Aboriginal schools in the outback of Australia.
Mm.
Every one of those has one of the original red cats in it.
Oh, wow.
We sell a lot in UK. We sell a lot in Spain. We sell a lot in Germany, I think, Australia, Canada, mainly U.S. though.
Mm-hmm. It just goes up to your chest like that?
Yeah, that's it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
and when it's working right, you can't even tell that it's on. This is an infrared.
Wow. Are a lot of these in Portland public schools?
Not so much in Portland. Beaverton has a lot. Hillsboro. Mm-hmm. I think we're about to do a big deal with Forest Grove.
Oh, wow.
But we have a program here where every employee, every year, gets to donate a red cat for every kid that they have. Mm. Or in my case, for every grandkid. So I've given probably in the last 3 years, like 10 units. So if you figure we've got right 60 employees here, so probably there's 120 just get donated out here.
Mm.
So that's kind of cool.
That's great. Where have you donated mostly?
To my grandkids' school. So mine have gone to Highton in Meadow Park.
Okay.
And it was a great school. My oldest grandkids went to McKinley.
Mm.
Did you have one of these?
I got one.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Thanks, Don.
All right.
That's fascinating. I'm glad I got to see it up close because when I was looking at the website, it was sort of...
Yeah, and it... You know, the first time my daughter's a teacher in Portsmouth Middle School, and the first time we put one over there, I just couldn't believe it because the teacher turned it on, and it didn't sound like it was amplified, but it was like you could just hear better.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And if it's set right, it's not like, you know, when you're talking through a microphone, mm-hmm. it sometimes kind of sounds amplified. If it's set right, all you know is that you hear better. So.
Mm.
And I go to Highton School where we got them, the teachers walking around, they've all got the microphones hanging on. It's great feeling to see
those. That's great.
So,